World War Z is an oral history of the zombie war, and some people are still processing exactly what happened, both in their own lives and still trying to figure out that could this actually have happened? But it did. In World War Z, you'll find out just how close we came to not being able to be around to talk about it. That the zombies almost did take over the world. And I want to address here coming up with historian Max Brooks. I want to get into a couple of emails I had gotten. One guy who's has a cousin in the Navy who said that he hears that they are still searching for zombies underneath the water. And that there is a complete, you know, a military program out there to both isolate and to contain underwater zombies. How could that possibly be happening? Well, we'll tell you about that in just a second. And we were talking about myths a little bit before the top of the hour. You know, some people think it was just a rumor that that in the coldest areas of the world, zombies go dormant for the winter and then come back strong in the spring. Well, I'm here to tell you, I survived it. I saw that for myself. We'll tell you more about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Max Brooks, I also want to get to a couple other questions that I don't know were in your book. I'm trying to think if that you ever addressed some of these questions that I'm getting about zombies. I'll throw it out at you, and you tell me how you feel about this. But first, let's get to that question about the Navy and about the underwater search and destroy missions that are going on, because zombies were not dependent on oxygen, obviously. Being the undead, they did survive quite well underwater.
Yes, they did. We know that under situations of high pressure, extreme cold, there are less organisms that will aid decomposition. And therefore, yes, we don't know how many hundreds of thousands or possibly millions of zombies are roaming the ocean floors now.
What are they eating?
At the moment, nothing. Nothing. But we also know that they do not need the kind of sustenance to survive.
The idea of them being underneath the water, just walking along the bottom of the oceans or lakes, for that matter, brings us back to that what may some turn out to be patient zero, or at least one that we could know about the boy and his father that were diving, and he got bit by something.
Yes, we know that we suspect it began in the water. And hopefully it will end there.
Yeah, yeah. So then you've heard, or you've been able to confirm that, in fact, there are these sort of search and destroy missions that are going on.
Oh,
Navy,
yeah.
Navy subs, Navy what? What are they doing?
Not just our navies, but navies around the world, using a deep scan sonar, using submersibles, using hard suits, ADS, atmospheric diving suits. Yes, it's a full-on international cooperation. As anybody living near the coast will tell you, your kids just aren't allowed to swim in water that isn't clear. It's that simple.
Right. You know, but again, some people put that down as rumor. I mean, it's so funny how they get that gets contextualized kind of in our puny brains as being, come on, that can't possibly be true. Like this idea of being able to go dormant in ice and snow and then come back just as strong in the spring. And that is an ongoing problem. I know that for out of, you know, sort of up here in Minnesota, that's just not that surprising. And that a lot of people are in these areas where they're overrun in the spring, where suddenly, you know, by fall, everything seems to be going okay again. And then it just comes roaring back.
Yeah, that is another misconception. That winter means that they're gone. No, they're not. They are simply frozen, and they will thaw, and they will be back.
In this way, zombies are much more like a virus. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's exactly what they are. They are a walking virus, and they behave virally, in that a predator will not overhunt its territory. A predator is an intelligent being. A virus will spread and will infest, even if it means destroying the host. They are the virus, and we as the human race are their host.
And is there any evidence at all of any kind of consciousness in terms of, like, you know, a mass mind where zombies may be communicating with each other, or like bees, somehow they're able to signal, here's the food source over here. I mean, do we have any, or is it just all purely random walking?
It is purely random. One of the big misconceptions is that there are zombie scouts who will then moan and attract other zombies. That's not true at all. What happens is a zombie will see you, he will moan, it will moan, and its moan will attract other zombies. And that is not intentional. That is simple random.
Now the interesting correction on the pronoun, you went from he to it. Tell me about that.
They are asexual, and they are no more masculine or feminine than the AIDS virus. And that's how they must be viewed. They must be viewed as a walking plague.
And non-human, in the sense that we can't get caught up in whether or not we recognize the person or we knew them as living, because that's just not who they are anymore.
No. What has happened is the virus has literally carjacked the human body and driven off in it. And that's how you must look at it, an empty shell that once belonged to someone else.
You know, in the Twin Cities, and I know this is true for a lot of other cities, but it's been going on here for a very long time. Lots of largely young people have zombie nights, and they had them for years before the zombie wars, and they don't have them obviously anymore because it's just not funny. But it was an interesting thing. Every year they would get together and they would, you know, put makeup on their faces and walk around and go brains and walk really slowly and chase after pedestrians and shoppers. And it was kind of a funny thing every year that they would have this. Was that a good thing in terms of our preparation for the zombie wars, or did that have negative ramifications?
No, it was neither good nor bad. It's a simple fact that young people feel invincible, as they always do. Everything is a joke until they suddenly become confronted with their own mortality.
Are there any known cases, and I know I'm probably asking you to stray off the topic a little bit, but do you know of any cases of people who did not respond to somebody walking toward them malevolently simply on the basis that they thought it's just more kids playing dress up?
I've never heard of that happening, but obviously there were people who had no idea what they were confronting. Someone shuffles towards you, you think they're hurt, you think they're sick, you go to help them, and before you know it, it's too late.
Right. What was the most common way that zombies kill? I mean, I know that sounds probably like a very basic question, but for people who never actually personally saw it, thank God, how did that happen? What was the kind of standard way that the zombies would go about as a predator?
It's the standard swarm attack in which you are grabbed and you are bitten. I shouldn't say small percentage, but there's a lesser percentage of people who were swarmed and eaten to the bone than we believe. What usually happened was someone was bitten, they escaped, infected, and expired later on, and then reanimated.
Hmm. And the best form of defense, I mean, you wrote the zombie survival guide before the zombie outbreak. What of your theories on how to survive a zombie attack ended up being the most helpful? And was there anything in the book that you had originally written that turned out, you know, not to be of any use?
Well, the book was written for the individuals, not for the governments.
Oh, so, good point.
So it's two completely different ideologies.
Right. But in terms of like individuals that had your book and were going to go by the zombie survival guide to survive a zombie attack, did later on, if you found out whether or not anything was helpful or not helpful?
Fortunately, I found that I certainly didn't lead people astray, which would have been too much of a burden to bear.
Right.
Whether I saved people or not, I have no idea.
Are you comfortable with being called a hero?
No, I don't think – I think there's people who did much more, sacrificed much more, more than me. I'm no more a hero of this war than Homer was a hero of the Battle of Troy.
World War Z, the oral history of the zombie war, written by Max Brooks, giving us perhaps the first true kind of God's eye view of what happened during the zombie war that broke out after the Great Panic. Can I tell me then some of the heroes and villains as you see them looking back now over the last 10 years or so?
Well, I think one of the heroes was obviously the U.S. president at the time. I think he was the one who took over after the Great Panic. I think he was truly brilliant, gifted, courageous, made the hard decisions, and the hard decisions which ended up killing him. That would be a hero. A villain, as much as you can say villains, I think one of the people I interviewed said it best. She was just an ordinary citizen, and she said, if you want to blame someone, blame me, because that's what happens in a democracy. And I think she really touched on something insightful and uncomfortable.
And which one was that you interviewed?
This is Mary Jo Miller.
Okay.
And her philosophy is, in a democracy, you forfeit your right to point the finger at your leaders. Because in a democracy, we are all the leaders. We are all responsible. We are all involved. And as opposed to, say, a totalitarian government, where you give up your rights. With freedom comes a lot of responsibility and a lot of homework. And I think that her philosophy is not what people want to hear, but I think it was very accurate.
Tell me why you think some countries fared better as you look down over. I mean, when you're talking about Mary Jo Miller, you're talking about the architect, well, one of them anyway, of a zombie defense system, right? I mean, am I getting it right? She's the woman who came up with.
She didn't come up with the idea of the fortified planned community, but she is certainly living in one now.
Okay, are there some governments that we can look back on it and we could say, as a whole, this is, you know, like a best practices,
yeah,
that we could see some countries did better because A, and some countries did worse because of B.
Yes, we for example, we can say that Great Britain did exceedingly well in retreating to the Antonine Wall and in using fortified motorways. We can say that Russia could have done much better in that they used basically World War II tidal wave tactics, which, of course, as in World War II, led to victory, but cost millions of lives.
When we're talking about millions of lives, it sort of seemed like sort of inevitable that millions of lives were going to get lost anyway, because we were so late to the party in terms of how we were going to stop it. For those people who were doctors, people who were on the ground, the individuals that you interviewed for World War Z, who do you admire most?
You know, there's many. I'd have to say I interviewed so many different people. I interviewed a witness to India closing its mountain path who actually met General Raj Singh. I interviewed the first officer of a Chinese submarine who spent most of the war hiding beneath the ocean depths and then eventually emerged to try and help liberate his country.
Right.
There are so many stories and so much pain and so much triumph and so much joy in the face of sorrow. I think it's hard to single them out.
As you're looking ahead, I mean, and there's obviously a lot of work to do. What countries are facing still the greatest challenges from this point forward? I know that we're doing better than others, but where are they struggling the most, and is there anything that we could be doing better to help them?
Well, I think there's huge swaths of the planet that are still deeply infested, but there's also parts that won't let us help them. For example, we know that there are parts of Russia, particularly in the south, in the republics that they have recently reclaimed, that are infested. Will they let us help? No. They have closed their borders, and they're dealing with it on their own terms. Will this lead to an eventual reinfection of the world? Possibly, which is exactly what happened in China. This could be the second China. We don't know.
Is the worst of it over?
For the moment, yes. It's definitely the worst is over. It's now time to rebuild, and it's time to learn from our mistakes.
And now that, you know, reflect a little bit on the role of organized religion in this, too, because I think there was, you know, there might have been a higher expectation for some people on the role of the church, for example, or in how people are sort of repairing their communities. In your studies for the UN post-war commission report, did you get it at all into that?
Well, you know, what I found was that religion is like any tool. It's all in how it's used. There were certain religious leaders who really did save lives, not just physically, but emotionally, and continue to build their communities to this day. There were others that predicted that it was the end and simply ordered their flocks to roll over and die.
Gosh, not more of that. That happened more than just the rumors?
Yes, unfortunately, it did happen. And it happened in all countries and in all religions. You know, unfortunately, we're all human beings, and no matter which gods we pray to, they can all be perverted.
The UN's role in all of this, I think a lot of folks would have thought you tell me, as you were involved with it, I don't want to color your answer. Some people wouldn't have had high hopes for the UN on this. How did they perform during the international zombie crisis?
They performed well towards the end. You know, the UN did not perform well in the beginning. They performed about as well as they have done with anything else.
Right. Okay.
But eventually, they did get their act together, and I think more importantly, have been a great source of hope in the rebuilding. I think maybe the UN didn't help us win the war, but I think they may help us win the peace.
You know, we had for years we've been watching zombie movies. We said zombies have been part of our culture and many other countries. Traditions, either informally or formally, like Mexico, you know, the Day of the Dead, all of the stuff that goes on down there. But if there is something that ended up being very true in the experience, in that the zombies, when they attacked, were very much like how we thought they would be.
Yeah.
And that's different, because if it had been, say, like werewolves or vampires or something like that, I don't even know how that would have worked out, but it was zombies, and zombies have a unique character in that they're always coming at us. They don't know anything else but then to come at us.
Yes, that is how they are. And you would think that since we had been warned by media, we would know. But, you know, remember, we had many plagues in our existence as a species, and they certainly didn't prepare us for the plague that followed after.
What's the great lesson of World War Z, as you write it?
Never forget. Never forget. Never forget what happened. Never let it happen again.
Ominous and necessary. World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war. Well, let's take a little time coming up to get to know Max Brooks, the author, a little bit better. And about this cautionary tale that he has written for us, World War Z. And also coming up a little bit later on this evening, we're going to talk to somebody else who has a cautionary tale for us, a fiction writer who is here to tell us that we can learn from our need to explore the horrific. Doug Clegg, the winner of the Bram Stoker Award and the International Horror Guild Award, coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I could have danced all night. But it's time to take a little time off of our little radio skit with Max Brooks coming up. World War Z is the book. It's just fabulous. Great big fun. You probably already knew about it anyway, but I had a great time with that. You can link up to him through our website at coasttocoastam.com. We'll talk more about the book and also the future of the book in just a moment. But online at coasttocoastam.com, too, there's the blog up, and I put up some thoughts on this movie, Paranormal Activity, which I had a chance to see earlier today. We'll talk more about that with our guest next hour, too, about the nature of horror and the role that it plays in our lives. And also, too, about some of the themes in Doug Clegg's work that got him the Bram Stoker Award. It's all our big buildup to Ghost to Ghost a.m. coming up on Halloween night. It's my first chance to ever host a ghost-to-ghost night, and this is incumbent on you to be able to tell your ghost story, your personal experience well. So we'll give you some tips, too, on how to relate a story, as well as Max Brooks just did it, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, thank you, Max Brooks, author of World War Z, for being such a fun conversation partner there in this little
My pleasure. Thank you.
Impromptu ad lib. You are a good sport.
Thank you.
Presenting your book that way, showing it as opposed to telling about it, is partially inspired by your father, Mel Brooks.
Oh, of course. Thank you. Thank you.
No, I mean that. I grew up a big fan of the 2000-year-old man and the 2013-year-old man sketches. And I loved Carl Reiner's part in that. I always thought it was so cool how he was, when he was interacting with your dad on that, how he would move the story along and then get from one joke to the next joke. And I studied those albums. I was a student of the 2013-year-old man album.
Now, they're great collaborators, those two.
And it was nice. Carl Reiner, as I understand it, contributed to the audiobook version of World War Z.
He is. He's on the audiobook of World War Z as the Mossad agent. He's just brilliant.
The story moving forward, World War Z, it's heading into, it's going to be a movie, but I hear kind of conflicting reports about how the movie's coming along. What do you hear?
Well, I can tell you that Mark Forster is the director, and just had lunch with him actually a few weeks ago. And he's either the world's greatest liar or he really wants to make this movie.
You've been on some fan sites talking about that because there were some reports that he was not going to direct it and they were looking for a new director and they were looking for a script rewrite.
What happened was at Comic-Con, it got out that there is a new writer, Matt Carnahan, who's taking over from J. Michael Straczynski. And I know this is going to come as a shock, but the internet posted something that was not accurate.
And so not accurate, meaning the writer has changed, but not the director.
Exactly.
Okay. And so do you have an idea of when the movie might actually grace the screen?
Good question. Let's hope it takes not as long as it took Omega Man to feature the new I Am Legend.
Did you like I Am Legend?
I did. I was not expecting the ending. I thought that for them to do what they did to the Fresh Prince was awesome.
Yeah, there's two endings I heard, though. Did you ever see the original ending?
No.
It's on the DVD.
Oh, really? I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, there's the alternate ending. I won't ruin it for other people, but it's 180 degrees different than the ending that made it into the theaters. And it did not test well.
Ah, what a shock.
Yeah, so they went and they changed it. But I actually am sort of more fond of the original, more ambiguous ending, and truer to the book, I think, probably.
Yeah.
But I never read the book, so my son did, and he told me about that. In fact, my son is a big fan of yours, and was very excited to see that you have a graphic novel version of World War Z, or at least part of it.
Well, actually, of Zombie Survival Guide.
Oh, that's the graphic novel version of the Zombie Survival Guide?
Yes, what I did was in the back of Zombie Survival Guide, I have these zombie attacks throughout history. And I took 11 of those stories and worked with an illustrator to adapt them into a graphic novel. And it's called Zombie Survival Guide Recorded Attacks.
Ah, okay. Now I understand that better. I thought the recorded attacks part was a reference to the World War Z stories.
So. No. See, in Zombie Survival Guide, I have a chronology of zombie attacks throughout history. So 11 of those stories are now illustrated.
And you can tell how long that graphic novel stayed on my desk. As soon as my 16-year-old saw it, he took it with him. So I didn't see it other than the cover. And I know he's very excited about that. I think what you did here is really interesting work. Trying to, you know, taking this, using the story, the allegory of the zombie attack to expose kind of some of our national and international weaknesses and strengths, and to use the past as a prologue of what would happen under these circumstances. And I hope that we didn't, you know, scare anybody too badly as we were talking about this sort of matter-of-factly. But there is something about zombies that's kind of particularly unnerving, I think, as opposed to other types of fantastic creatures.
Yeah, well, because zombies are apocalyptic. And because you don't go find them as you would have to go find a werewolf or another creature, you know, zombies come to you, and they come to you in the millions.
The Zombie Survival Guide addressed that. I remember when that came out, I loved some of the lessons for surviving a zombie attack. And I remember, I don't remember all of them, but there was one of them about wearing tight clothes and cut your hair.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it's just common sense. A lot of it is the stuff you'd find in any survival guide, which is zombies would grab baggy clothes and long hair.
Right. But some of it seems obviously predicated on the ways in which the zombie-human interaction has been portrayed on the screen as people continually do dumb stuff around zombies.
Well, you know, people ask me if I did a lot of research by watching a lot of zombie movies, and the truth is I didn't. I only watched one. I only watched the original Dawn of the Dead. That was it.
Right.
And then from then on, all my research was real.
Real meaning?
Or meaning it was either taken from real-life survival skills or a lot from my own Army ROTC manual.
You were ROTC?
I was ROTC during the first Gulf War.
Were you really?
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
In college. How about that? What led you, Max Brooks, to go ROTC?
Well, you know, as a good idealistic liberal, I wanted to give back. And as a Jew, I thought, wow, I actually get to fight in a war against Arabs and not Vietnamese. How cool is that? So that was a long time ago, and it was very different. And Not ashamed of it, though. It was a good time.
Tell me about what's changed then for you on that.
Well, I think certainly the war has changed. I think that Desert Storm, to this day, I think maybe wasn't a good war, if any war is good, but it certainly was a limited war, and it certainly was a hell of a lot smarter than the wars we're fighting now.
And did you ever see any action?
No. Okay. The only action I saw was blowing out my knees and my back, and getting sciatica, which haunts me to this day.
Doesn't really. How did you do that? Do you mean in training or?
Yeah,
or
just training, just not never being physical before, and then running constantly, and then suddenly just tearing my body up.
What came from the ROTC manuals that made it into the Zombie Survival Guide?
Well, dehydration. That's what they taught us at Camp Pendleton when we did our FTX, our field training exercise. Drink water, and when you're done drinking water, drink some water.
Right.
Things like the M16, I can tell you from personal experience, it is a POS.
What does that mean? Oh, I see, POS. Yes, now I understand that. I thought it was a military term
for a second. Right. It is an inferior design that we've been saddled with for, God, since the 1960s.
Really? And that's interesting to hear you say that, because I haven't heard anybody say that before. It's not considered a good field weapon? Why do we still have it?
It's because we've kept improving on it. And part of it was just we're in too deep with the company that makes it. And the Army just did recent field tests about which was the best assault weapon as far as just durability, which can take the most crap and dirt and dust.
Right.
And the new M4 came in last.
Okay, and so what came in first?
Probably something German.
Right. Or
I can tell you right now, the AK-47, it's been around since 1947, and it's still one of the most reliable assault rifles ever made.
Yeah, I don't know tons about weapons, but I know that there is a legacy of simplicity.
And that it's
easy,
exactly,
easy to manufacture, easy to clean, easy to take care of.
And that's what I say. If you're in a zombie outbreak and there's no quartermaster to go to, and there's no army, and there's no backup, and you only can have one gun, you want something that's not going to break.
Right. And go for the head. Always go for the head.
That's right.
Where does that come from? The idea of zombies go for the head, vampires go for the heart.
Well, you know, think about it, that going for the head is actually how you kill a human being anyway. I mean, just think of simple physiology. All we are really are brains, and our heart, our lungs, our digestive tract, everything else is just a support mechanism. Like when you shoot someone in the heart, they don't die because their heart is destroyed. They die because their heart can't pump oxygen and blood to the brain.
Okay, fair enough. I see that.
So if you had a brain that didn't need a support system, you'd have to cut out the middleman, and that's the zombie.
Then what does it What does that tell us, though, about why we have to kill vampires by stabbing them with a wooden stake through the heart?
That told us that Bram Stoker had had a lot of whiskey when he wrote that.
So, blades, you say, you know, always keep, better to keep some big, massive machete around, just in case.
Well, you know, I try to think logistically, and I say, you know, look, there's 300 million Americans. How many bullets can you possibly have?
Right.
So you want something that you don't have to reload.
It was already a shortage of bullets. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the zombie war actually happened right now, we wouldn't have enough bullets to go around.
No, certainly not to kill 300 million zombies.
What is it? I mean, I asked you this at the bottom of the hour, but honestly, as you have people who are reading and then reacting to World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war, what is it that you are heartened by as people read the book? And what message are you trying to send out that people aren't getting?
Well, there's the message that people aren't getting. There's the firearm click. These are the wannabe Rambos who just think that massive firepower can solve any problem. And these people have watched way too much G.I. Joe when they were a kid and didn't pick up any manual of military history. And firepower only goes so far. We had all the firepower in the world in Vietnam. Look what good it did us. So that never gets through. There's so many things that go involved in fighting a war. But what gets through, I have to say, it's really nice when people come up to me and say, hey, I was in Iraq, or my husband's in Iraq and he loves your book. I can't tell you how many times I've autographed books to people coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool. And they like it because it allows them to sort of have sort of an internal conversation about what they went through. And at the same time, not have it be about what they went through.
Yeah, I think it's safe. You know, yeah. It's a lot safer than if I was writing about the real stuff.
You know, I have to say, one of my older teenager would probably fall into that category of the gun nut type. Not an actual gun, but I mean, he is like Mr. Kill every zombie he can see on any video game. Nazi zombies is a big thing with him right now. And, you know, they love going over and playing these games. And when I told him about World War Z, he was like, oh, I so wish that we had a zombie attack right now. He said that would be so cool. And I said, no, I don't think so. I said, you know, if it really did happen, it wouldn't be cool. But I think that's the way a lot of people look at it, because they don't really see it as the attacking virus. They see it as sort of a permission to have a 3D version or a real life avatar version of one of these video games. And yeah. It wouldn't be like that at all.
No, it wouldn't be like that. There'd be, like I said, there'd be a lot of people that would die of starvation and drinking bad water and conventional disease from not being able to get rid of their own waste.
And it's one thing to kill Nazi zombies, but it's another thing if you actually had to pull the trigger on people that you recognized.
Yeah, yeah. And there's no zombie video game that I know where people die of dysentery.
That would be an interesting kind of dimension to
yeah.
the game, I
and
think.
And in a real zombie outbreak, that would kill a lot of people.
Yeah, you have to kill more zombies before your character has dysentery up
yeah.
on the screen. That'd be an interesting twist.
That's a game I'd like to see.
No, like it's what I'd like to hear about. I don't know if I really want to see it. So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, now that Recorded Attacks is out, I have another graphic novel, which is not zombies. It's not even horror. It's a true story. And it's a war story, and it's being illustrated. And I'm also writing the script for a new miniseries for G.I. Joe, the comic book.
Get out. Really?
Yeah, yeah. I sent them a sample story, and they liked it so much, they let me have 5 issues all to myself.
What about the G.I. Joe character? Because probably the version that some people know best would be the TV, the sort of the cheaply made TV cartoon version.
Yeah, which is the ones I grew up on. And right. I wanted to go deeper, and I want to write stories about who these people were, and it's tentatively titled Hearts and Minds, and it's sort of delving into their personalities and their histories and sort of what makes them who they are.
So any insights you would be willing to offer us about G.I. Joe?
Well, I mean, I can say things like the character I submitted was the Cobra Saboteur Firefly. And what's it like to be a saboteur? It's not as glamorous and exciting as it looks in the TV show, but it's possibly more real.
You know, I think that was, I read an interview with you some time ago, not long, I don't know where it was in the timeline of when the book came out, but you were reflecting on World War Z in terms of how it represented terrorism, that if we used the sort of the mindless zombies as a way of looking at terrorists who don't who have an unnuanced approach to who they will kill. They're just going to go in and blow up as many people as they can, and that there really isn't any more sympathy for them than there would be for zombies. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Is that, I mean, I remember the quote, but I don't remember how deeply you go into that. And was that, did that go a lot into what you were thinking when you wrote the book?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's, for me, it's very terrifying to be up against an enemy that there is no gray area. That you have to destroy them before they destroy you. And that could be terrorists, that could be Nazis, that could be the Japanese in World War II. But I mean, the idea that there is no negotiating, that it's literally you must wipe them out. And I think that's a very terrifying war to fight. And that's the kind of war I think it would be against zombies.
I got the... I didn't finish every one of the oral histories, so pardon me if you address this, but I always thought that was interesting in the response after 9/11 with some people who spoke about the Al-Qaeda terrorists as though they're just kind of misunderstood and that, you know, we could appeal to their greater nature and that they would let some people live and some people not live. And I think I just don't see that. I think they knew very well that they were killing indiscriminately, and that meant killing Muslims in the World Trade Center, and they didn't care about that either.
Well, yeah, I think that's the problem. You know, conservatives want to kill them all and let God sort them out, and liberals just want to apologize for, because clearly it must be our fault.
Right.
And I think the thing is, yeah, you know, there are people out there that are just caught in the middle, and we have to be very careful not to turn those people into terrorists.
Right.
But once they're already terrorists and
right.
they've sworn a blood oath to kill us,
right.
it don't matter how nice we are.
Right. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. We could say the same thing about zombies, that let's stop people from becoming zombies wherever possible.
Right.
But once they've become zombies, then all they want to do is eat our brains.
Right. And they're really shoot them in the head.
We can't just give them a hand or a finger and say, here, chew on this. I'm so sorry you're a zombie. It must have been terrible for you to be a zombie. You probably just shoot them in the head.
Exactly.
Okay. Have you seen Zombieland yet?
I haven't seen it, but I read the book.
Oh, well, I think you as a movie experience goes, it's a lot of fun. I will look forward to seeing yours more, though. World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war. It's in soft cover. You can pick it up everywhere. It's a fun read, and along with the Zombie Survival Guide and the new graphic novel companion to that. Thank you so much, Max Brooks. I really appreciate the time and your great spirit in jumping in like that.
Thanks, man. Be safe.
Have a good day. Yes, thank you. I will be safe. I'll lock my doors and windows tonight. And the horror continues. Doug Clegg is an award-winning horror writer. I saw Paranormal Activity today. I want to tell you a little bit more about that movie, what I think it says to us, and then also reflect a little bit more on what horror means to us as a society, why we love it, and how to tell a good horror story, getting us ready for Ghost to Ghost coming up in a few weeks on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.